Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we cover the people, the stories, and the events in Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for the show today, Greta Anderson, and I'm joined by my co-host, Vivica Dillard. Good morning, Vivica.
Good morning.
Our main topic today is the oil pipeline that has been proposed to transport crude oil from the Bakken oil fields of North Dakota through the state of Iowa to a major distribution center in southern Illinois. Yesterday, I reached the media relations representative of that company and recorded an interview, and we've got some local people here ready to weigh in as well in just a few minutes. But first, I thought we could hear an extended sports update from Vivica, our sports correspondent here on Local Talk. Vivica, I hear it's been a big week in terms of the basketball draft and, of course, the finals of the World Cup soccer.
Yeah, it's a... Actually, we had a lot going on with free agency, players who are now out of contract, just trying to do a couple team hopping and, you know, get more money, get more bang for their buck. So I was able to sit down, catch up with Merle from Merle on the Move and see what he had to say about this. Good morning and welcome to another Local Talk Sports segment with Viv. And I'm here today with a special guest. Some of you may know him from Saturday nights, Merle on the Move. Merle, say what's up to the people.
What's up? What's up?
So today we got a pretty good sports segment going on. We're going to get into some basketball, free agency. We'll get into some World Cup action and, you know, wherever else we go with that. So first up in sports, we're going to talk free agency.
Free agency.
Yeah. Who do you think came out the winner so far?
A lot of people is probably thinking that Cleveland came out, you know, which they did. They did come out a lot better and stronger. Who would have thought that would have happened? But my opinion, Chicago. I think the Bulls made out the best.
Good choice.
Because now it's no dynasty in the East, you know, to worry about the Heat. So I'm looking forward to seeing what happens. But overall, I think the Bulls did pretty good. Knicks did okay, too, keeping mellow.
Mm-hmm.
Houston and the Lakers were the losers, though, if you ask me.
Houston and the Lakers are the losers?
Yeah, I mean, we lost Paul Gasol, you know. Like I say, he went over to the Bulls, which helped out.
You got Swaggy P.
Yeah. But, you know, I was not a big fan of Gasol. I like his brother, Mark.
Yeah.
He's big, but he has some power. A little big weak to me, you know what I'm saying? He wasn't strong. He could shoot the lights out. You know what I mean? Good rebounder. Just weak in the paint.
Mm, yeah, Lakers did get one of the most overrated guards, too. Jeremy Lin?
Yeah. I think that was a good move, though. I mean, not really big on Lin, but he's an upgrade to what we had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, remember, we're talking about the Lakers. What I got on right now?
Kobe.
Lake Show. That's what we do. So even down to the Jordans, Lakers. But, yeah, I think Houston, they dropped up. They wanted to get Melo. That was the main goal, was to get Melo, and not getting Melo or Chris Bosh, I think, put them in the bottom.
Okay. So you said the East doesn't have a dynasty anymore.
Nope.
All
even
right.
Even Paul Pierce left.
Okay. So what about Cleveland?
Not a dynasty.
Not a dynasty?
Even LeBron said his own mouth. They won't be doing nothing this year. You know?
Yeah, I think
it'll take a couple of years. Now, I will give LeBron this. He did take Cleveland to the finals when he was younger by himself.
With nobody.
Yeah. So he can do it. Just I don't believe he'll do it next year.
Even with Andrew Wiggins and Kyrie Irving.
They got to prove. Now, Kyrie can prove himself, but Wiggins ain't proved nothing yet. Just because he did in college don't mean he's going to do it in the league.
Very true. So what about the Pistons?
Tell me about the Pistons.
They got Caron Butler. They got him for a two-year contract.
Mm-hmm.
And they also picked up DJ Augustine. I don't know how much that's really going to affect anything.
I was going to look here something major.
They
get D. Rose or somebody?
No.
What's going on over there?
We got, speaking of D. Rose, he did get picked up, one of 19 players for the USA team.
That's what's up.
But there is a lot of controversy behind that.
What's going on? Talk to me.
Because he's been out two seasons, so it's like, why? What has he done to be on that team? So what do you think about that?
I think they're not going to do much. As far as the NBA this year, I think overall, the teams that's going to be the ones to beat is going to be Spurs again.
You think so?
I think so. Did Ginobili, did he get a new contract or did he leave?
Ginobili?
Yeah.
I haven't heard anything, but I don't think anybody's going anywhere.
Yeah, I was talking about that. But yeah, San Antonio's still going to be the team to beat, man. I mean, because it's no way that you can outplay them right now. I mean, if you watch the style of nobody else plays basketball like San Antonio, in my opinion, you know.
And they haven't. And the thing about that is they are a fundamentally sound team.
Yes.
And the thing that's crazy, people say all of this stuff about LeBron James being the greatest player and all these teams being the greatest team. The Heat were the greatest dynasty, Dwayne Wade. And I saw this is the craziest thing I've ever seen. Dwayne Wade and LeBron James were the best duo ever.
No.
But people single-handedly count out the San Antonio Spurs.
Look at it this way. When LeBron got to the finals the first time with Cleveland, who beat him? San Antonio. His last finals he was in, who beat him?
San Antonio. And who was on both of those teams?
Tim Duncan.
Who was coaching both of those teams?
Pop. Kicking, pass and kick. You know, pass and kick. That's their philosophy. Pass and kick. All
there, there's a reason he's been on that team for 18 years.
And that's another thing. You know, that style of basketball, like I said, it's nobody else plays like that. And they, it wins. It's winning basketball. You know what I mean? It's no I in that one. You know what I mean? Because almost every night it was a different superstar for the Spurs. And they were handing the heat to their butt. Mm-hmm. Handing it to them.
Mm-hmm. They're not just depending on Tim Duncan to put up 30 a night.
Exactly. If LeBron was having an off night, it was no help for the Heat.
The fact that Leonard got MVP just shows that you never know who's going to show up.
True.
Like, you really don't know who's going to show up. So, what's next for the Heat?
Chris Bosh better show up. He got a max contract. You know, they say he, which is true, he was a 20-plus points a night player. But with LeBron, you know, he sacrificed his game, you know, and you had to because it was LeBron. But he's got a max contract now. So that's superstar status. He wasn't even mentioned in the top five power forwards or forwards in the league. Mm. But now he's getting paid like he's one of the top ones. So let's see. And if Wade is healthy, you know, they got the number one.
Yep. Shabazz from UConn.
Yeah, they got him. They got Luol Deng from Cleveland. So, you know, they'll be okay. They should still make the playoffs. Now, if they lost Bosh, no.
They wouldn't make the playoffs?
No, they wouldn't make the playoffs. I think they'll still make the playoffs. The East. The Knicks, you know what I mean, they got Carmelo, but they need a lot of help over there.
Yeah, they have Carmelo Anthony. That's about it.
But look who made it in the East. The Wizards. Can you believe it? The Bobcats made it to the playoffs. Come on. You know about the Pistons. The Bobcats. Michael Jordan's team made it to the playoffs. People forget. That was a great accomplishment. When I had the worst record ever in basketball, you know? And then to make it to the playoffs, man, he should be standing on his hands clapping his feet right now.
Yeah.
You know? And then you had the Wizards. The Wizards won. They went to another round, you know? So
yeah, they proved my city wrong. Yeah,
so no. And I don't think the Nets are going to be too good this year. Jason Kidd, he got fired.
He with Milwaukee. He teamed up with Jabari. Now, how is that for a rookie? You coming in and your first coach in the NBA is Jason Kidd.
Hall of Famer, point guard.
Yeah, so that was a pretty good conversation I was able to have with Merle. I'm glad he was able to come in and, you know, discuss a couple things with me, because a lot of these things, like, you know, LeBron James, that's big on every station from CNN to HLN and ESPN. So it's one of those things that people all over are interested in seeing and talking about.
Right.
You know, including myself and Merle.
Well, you certainly gave me a workout. I think I got to go back to the books and study me some basketball.
Just sit down and watch ESPN for 24 hours. It'd be everything you need to know. Everything. Just don't change the channel for 24 hours. You'll be fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. Well, and I understand you and Mel also spoke about the World Cup. The news I know about that is that Germany won, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the excitement. Brazil kind of, they didn't even win the second best game, did they?
No, and that was the thing. People were so shocked to see how Brazil ended their World Cup run, especially since they were at home. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it ended terribly for them, to say the least.
But at least they didn't have a major collapse of a stadium, or, you know, the crowd control was okay. And, you know, the event itself went off.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, there's some light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, right? And they get to host the Olympics in 2 years.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I did not know that, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Vivica, for that report. Like I said, you're going to put us here at KHOI through our paces, and I think that's a good thing.
All right, anytime.
So, up for our next main story today, the Des Moines Register and Ames Tribune have been running front page stories for a couple of weeks now about a Texas company's plans to build a pipeline through the state of Iowa to carry crude from North Dakota to a distribution point in southern Illinois. And our listeners have been sending us links and asking us to cover this story. So we are going to oblige them today. Yesterday, I contacted the media spokesperson for the pipeline company to ask her a few questions about the pipeline. We'll have that interview in a moment. In our studio, we have a local guest, Franek Hasek, Polish name, I hear he's from Minnesota, assistant professor at the Department of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences, who worked for several years in the oil industry as a petrogeologist. So, and then later on, we'll be joined by Ralph Rosenberg, executive director of Iowa Environmental Council, and they'll be helping us understand why we should or should not be worried about this development. But first, let's start with my tape of the interview with the pipeline spokesperson.
I'm with Vicky Granada, Media Relations for Energy Transfer Partners, who is proposing to build a pipeline across Iowa to transport a crude petroleum product from the North Dakota oil fields. Welcome, Vicky.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So what exactly is this petroleum product? We've heard it called a volatile.
You know, I think that's been a little bit misconstrued. Certainly, you know, oil and gas products, you know, have some volatility to them, but that was the way that was phrased. I think where you're getting that, it was a little out of context. It is a light, sweet crude oil coming out of the Bakken Three Forks area. And what that particular comment was referring to was some of the incidents that have happened on rail when the rail cars have been transporting the crude out of North Dakota. Currently, rail and truck are the way most of the crude oil is being transported out of the Bakken. And the rail incidences have not been caused by the crude in the rail car, but the rail car's derailing, which then, you know, causes incidents with the crude. So I hope I made that clear, but that was a little bit misconstrued in some of the earlier articles about this. Right now, there's not a lot of infrastructure in the Bakken, and so there is, you know, more production of oil than we can get out and get to market. So we are looking to, you know, build a pipeline, as you said, that will start in North Dakota and will come down through South Dakota and Iowa and then into a terminaling hub near Patoka, Illinois. And from there, we'll be able to then offer our customers the option to move that crude to markets around the country. They can move it to Chicago. They can move it over to the New York area. They can put it into another existing pipeline that we've got and move it down to the Gulf Coast. So, again, it'll just be an opportunity to get some of that crude and get it out into the American cities.
Okay. So when your customers, as you call them, take that crude, they will be transporting it by rail, correct?
So once it gets to a Patoka, there'll be several options. One is an existing underground pipeline that we own. That is currently a natural gas pipeline, but we are in the process of changing that over to a crude line. So if they want to move it down to the Gulf Coast or in and around the Chicago area, there are existing underground pipelines that we can take the crude off of this pipeline at Patoka and put it in another pipeline.
Okay.
Then there will be, yes, if they, the, you know, other opportunities to move it further east out of a rail terminal there. So there will be a combination of methods that we can move this crude.
What is light sweet crude used for?
You know, crude, it's this, you know, crude in our country, you know, it goes to refineries and then it is, you know, ultimately used in, you know, all of the things in our daily lives that, you know, oil is a part of. So that includes going to refineries for, you know, ultimate use as a gasoline product. You know, crude is used in many of the daily products that we don't even think about. So it's got many end uses.
Plastics and things.
Sure, absolutely.
Many of our listeners have seen the diagonal path of the pipeline in relation to our state from the northwest corner of Iowa to the southeast corner of the state.
Yes.
And that would pass through Ames, which is where our studio is located, at the center of the state, maybe just a little bit south, according to the maps. What is the logic of taking that diagonal route?
Well, the way that you design a pipeline route is, one, you look, you know, for a number of factors. One is you do look for what is the most efficient route for the pipeline. But two, you also have to look at certainly any environmental concerns. We look to reduce any sort of environmental impact that we can. So you look for existing right-of-way so that you don't have to maybe establish a new one. You look for an existing right-of-way where you could, you know, put another pipeline in. So there's a lot of factors that go into determining what the most efficient route is.
Okay. When did your company, Energy Transfer Partners, first start negotiations with the people in charge in Iowa?
You know, that is the process that's going on as we speak. We just announced this project in late June. And so what we're rolling out now is, you know, communicating with the appropriate state agencies, because this pipeline does have to be approved on a state-by-state basis.
Does it have to also be approved on a county-by-county basis?
It's a state-by-state basis. We will have to work with counties on different permits, road crossings, those sorts of things, but the approval of the pipeline is at the state level.
So who do you talk to in Iowa?
You know, we'll be working with the Public Utilities Commissions. We'll be working with the Department of Natural Resources are among those that we'll be working with.
No elected officials?
Well, certainly we'll be communicating with elected officials and talking to them about this project. But the approval will come from the state agency.
Okay. I understand that your company, Energy Transfer Partners, has already begun ordering steel and negotiating construction contracts for the project.
That is all part of the process, yes. I mean, to build a pipeline, as you guys can imagine, one, it's a very significant investment, and two, you know, it takes time to build a project of this magnitude. And we are looking at, you know, being in service in this pipeline by the fourth quarter of 2016. So, yes, we need to start looking at where does the steel need to come from, who is qualified to build something like this. So certainly those discussions are underway. As a company, we look to first buy the materials and steel as locally as possible. So, you know, we look to the local areas, and then we look to buy American. So we try to keep as much as we can in terms of our product and supply that we need to purchase for this pipeline here in this country.
Could you understand a citizen's point of view that if you are already purchasing these materials and making the construction contracts, that, you know, in your mind it's a done deal, whereas our political process hasn't occurred yet?
We fully understand that this project is, you know, needs to be approved, and we need to get out and do communications about this. We will be holding a series of open houses in Iowa. Those are in the planning stages right now. We look to be doing those probably in the mid to late part of August. We know we need to reach all the officials and meet with all the state agencies, but it's just part of the process. We need to be planning now in hopes that we get the appropriate approvals so that when we get these approvals, we're ready to go. So that's, you know, that is the way that this type of process works when you're dealing with a construction project of this magnitude.
What kind of lands will you be digging through? Are these privately owned lands, publicly owned lands?
You know, the exact route, what we are in the process now of, we have reached out to the landowners that are along the proposed route. And what we need to do is get permission from those landowners to get on their property and do surveys. We need to do civil surveys, and we need to do environmental surveys. So, and again, this would be anywhere where we're not going through an existing right-of-way. And so what we will need to do through those surveys is then determine the final, you know, route that we will be asking for permission on. So, you know, at this point, you know, we don't know exactly, because we don't have the final route determined, so we don't know exactly what we're crossing where until we actually are able to get on the properties and do the survey.
And will you be giving compensation to the landowners for their...
Absolutely. Any time that you buy right-of-way or buy... an easement through somebody's property, they are compensated.
And when the landowners have, you know, say a landowner gives the okay, do the landowner's neighbors have any say? You know, for instance, somebody might have a well that's right next to the proposed pipeline, and they would be immediately affected if the pipeline broke. Do the neighbors have any say, or does the general public in that area, or the county, the region, did they have any say?
Everybody can voice throughout this process, you know, to their elected officials and to your state agencies how they feel about this pipeline. We welcome all comments and all points of view. So, but in terms of, when we go in and negotiate and work with the landowners to, if we get the appropriate approvals and we work with the landowners for the right-of-way, it is the landowner, we deal directly with the landowner's property that we are crossing. But certainly everybody is invited to come to the open houses that will be holding, and everybody is welcome to work with their, you know, the officials there in Iowa to voice how they feel about it.
Pipelines do fail. There have been spills in Montana, North Dakota, Arkansas. What do we do if there's an accident in Iowa?
You know, there is our monitoring systems we've got around the country to control and monitor our pipelines 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So if there is a change or a release from one of our pipelines, it is immediately detected. That the pipelines are shut in, so the sections are isolated. And then, you know, we go out and do what we need to do to get the repaired and everything, you know, restored and cleaned up. It's something that, you're right, we do have incidences on our pipeline. We are fortunate that they are rare. And so, you know, when or if they do happen, we certainly are prepared to deal with that and to take care of what we need to take care of.
Well, thank you very much, Vicki.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Will you be willing to come back and talk to us about this as periodically as the pipeline develops or doesn't?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to.
Okay. Thank you, Vicki Granata from Energy Transfer Partners. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to Local Talk. This is one of your hosts, Vivica Dillard. I'm here with co-host Greta Anderson, and we are talking about a proposed pipeline running diagonally across the state of Iowa to carry crude from North Dakota to a distribution point in Illinois.
And we have two guests in the studio, Franek Hasek, an assistant professor at the Department of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences, who worked for several years in the oil industry as a petrogeologist. We also have Ralph Rosenberg, executive director of the Iowa Environmental Council. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with you, Franek. I'm sure a lot of our listeners are a little bewildered by the world of pipelines. It's something we don't think about a lot. Is this a big project that's being proposed?
Well, most pipelines are big projects, but in terms of the length of this pipeline or the fact that it crosses big borders, this is probably a medium-sized pipeline. Hmm. From what I've read, it's going to be about 30 inches in diameter, you know, a little bit less than 3 feet. So that puts it probably as sort of an average-sized pipeline. There are certainly ones that can get much bigger than that, and there are some that are as small as 10 or 12 inches.
Okay. And does Iowa already have anything comparable to this under its soil?
From what I understand, Iowa has about 41,000 miles of pipelines buried underground, distributing natural gas to people's homes, having both oil and natural gas transit the state to other points. And so we do have a fairly well-developed network of pipelines, though I think most of that is for distribution of natural gas to people's homes.
Okay. The pipes go about 4 feet underground. That's typical?
I assume that's frost-related, and so they want to get it down below where our yearly freeze-thaw cycles could move the pipeline and injure it. So.
Okay. Well, here's my stupid question. Do pipelines run downhill, or do they need to be pumped?
Well, there's a little bit of both. And so when you design a pipeline for liquids, you tend to want it to run downhill because liquids are going to flow downhill. Now, there's going to be places where you need to increase the pressure to get that fluid to move, and so you might have a pumping station.
Yeah.
Now, if you think about moving something like natural gas, you might actually want your pipe to go a little bit uphill because gases are going to flow up because they're a little more buoyant. So.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. So I'm just thinking about the Des Moines River Valley, you mm-hmm. know, our very steep, majestic river valley that there, and that's just west of us here in Ames. Just walk us through how the pipeline would get from one side to the other.
Well, I haven't seen any of the schematics for how they're going to do this, but there are two ways that you can cross a river. You can either bury the pipeline under it through dredging, or you can build a little suspension bridge to hold the pipeline over it. And so I've seen these little suspension bridges over rivers in southern Illinois because that's the best way to do it in that part of the country, I guess. But also, for the most part, I think pipeline companies like the pipes to be underground because then they're not going to be they're going to be in a more stable environment, and they're not going to be prone to vandalism. So
okay, well, you know, the big pipeline in everybody's mind is the Keystone Pipeline, mm-hmm. and I thinking about this, I could come up with three really good reasons why people are opposed to the Keystone Pipeline. The first one being, and so let's just compare, you know, this pipeline to that. The first is, of course, that it's a Canadian company. It's Canadian fields that are being developed. And so economically, we're just sort of the middleman, and we're not benefiting, our country is not benefiting directly from the passage of oil through our land, except for the few jobs that are created when they dig it, mm-hmm. right? But the second one that I've heard a lot about is the environmental destruction of the tar sands mining that's going on in Canada. I've seen pictures of how devastating it is, and I have no idea about the relationship of those pictures and that, you know, idea to what's going on in North Dakota. Can you fill us in on kind of the environmental situation up in North Dakota as, you know, as far as their development of their oil fields there?
Yeah, the two types of petroleum deposits are about as different as two petroleum deposits could be. The Canadian tar sands are, like the name implies, basically loose sand that's been glued together with tar. And so they have to heat that up, or they have to add solvents, or they have to inject steam to get that tar into a more liquid state that then can be transported by a pipeline. And so often this involves mining techniques as opposed to sort of typical petroleum development, which involves wells and pumping. And so up there, it's basically a mining activity. So you have to move a certain number of cubic yards of earth to get a certain number of barrels of oil out. In North Dakota, it's more of a traditional oil and gas development in that they're drilling wells into the subsurface thousands of feet down to access these petroleum deposits. Now, it's a little bit new in that they're fracking. So they're doing this hydraulic fracturing process to break the rocks apart and liberate the oil in what's otherwise a very impermeable formation of rock. And so also the kind of oil that you get out of the two deposits is very different. One, the Canadian substance is very similar to asphalt, the stuff that glues our blacktop together, whereas the oil that they're getting out of the Bakken is a light, what's called light and sweets, and so that means it's a low density, low sulfur, and thus very high quality oil that is prized by a lot of refiners that want to make gasoline.
Okay. Fracking does have issues, though, right?
Right. There, you know, North Dakota is not known for abundant water supplies. And so one of the big issues always with fracking is, where do you get the water, and then what do you do with it when you're done? And so North Dakota is grappling as a state with how they decide where the water comes from and what are the responsible ways to dispose of that water in North Dakota.
Okay. And then we were speaking of three reasons. The third reason that people are really against the Keystone is simply that we are, in the bigger picture, we cannot continue to use fossil fuels and expect to have a stable climate, a stable existence here on our planet. Mm-hmm. Climate change is happening, and, you know, this huge influx of oil and petroleum into use is probably not going to help things at all. So in that sense, I suppose we're kind of on the same page when you compare the two pipelines.
The two pipelines will make these petroleum deposits, will make the petroleum from them less expensive. That's what it's going to do. If these two pipelines aren't built, those petroleum deposits will probably still be exploited, and that petroleum will probably still be burned in someone's engine or converted into plastic in a refinery. It's just going to be more expensive. These deposits are very large, and they're very relatively close to hungry markets. So the United States is a really hungry market for energy, and that this material will get to market. It's just a function of how safe is it going to get there and how expensive will it be at the end. Though making things more expensive will encourage, of course, people to choose other options if they're available.
Right. And she spoke, the representative spoke of the companies developing the minefields so fast that they can't keep up. Mm-hmm. Is that just a function of kind of capitalism, that once something's opened up, people get rights to the land and then
yep.
It's just a race to get that?
It's sort of like a gold rush in the early days. It's when someone proves the business model, then everyone rushes in to stake their claims. And a lot like the problems we're having here in Ames with students finding places to live, up in North Dakota, people are having problems with infrastructure because of the large influx of both people to work the fields, but also the necessities to move, you know, physically the drill rigs around to drill the new wells, as well as to get that product to customers elsewhere in North America. Because a lot of our refining infrastructure is on the Gulf Coast.
Right.
Right. We have there's a sort of a big refinery in Minneapolis and a big one in Northwest Indiana by Chicago. But otherwise, our refining infrastructure is really concentrated on the Gulf Coast, and I guess there's a little bit on the East Coast as well. And so the idea is that you leave your refineries in one place and you build your transport infrastructure to get there.
Well, let's bring Ralph into the conversation. You know, you mentioned that the pipeline is safe, the representative from the company also said this is the safest way to transport this material. But there are obviously some aspects of this that are not safe. And Iowa is crisscrossed with waterways and rivers. If there is any spill, there's little doubt probably that it'll get into the water. Is water quality your main concern, Ralph?
There's a laundry list of concerns, and some of them just start with the whole process. Basically, it almost appears that the company showed up overnight and said, we're going to do this. And so I think there is an almost a democratic kind of concern, like what is a process for making this decision that a company just decides we're going to do this pipeline? But even if you're supporting pipelines, there are many unanswered questions about the impact on water, on land, that haven't even been raised. So the burden should be on the company to prove that there's not going to be any kind of impact. The burden, so when the company representatives say, don't worry, it's not going to be spill, our response should be, I think not just environmental group or anybody, should be, is how are you going to be held accountable? So will you do monitoring? Well, they better do monitoring because for them to say there's not going to be any spills is not accurate. But so what are they going to do to minimize the spills? And what are they going to do to monitor in case there's a spill? Because these pipelines go all across the waters, wetlands, rivers, lakes. So there's that. And those questions are being asked and should be answered by the oil company. And we'll just see. I mean, some of them I just don't have the answers for. The next question is, if there is a spill, who pays for the damages? And I mean, I think the companies will say, well, we'll pay. But how do you know they pay? And in other areas of business and industry, in other areas of environmental protection, society or government says you need to put down like a deposit or a bond ahead of time to make sure, to give confidence that if there are damages, then the costs are going to be recovered. So I want to see those questions answered. And I think everyone wants to see those questions answered. And there's other things, too. We're continuing use on relying or dependence upon carbon-based fuels, and that we are, it's just ironic, we're in a state that's moving to the lead in the country, number one or two in terms of renewable, realizing it's electricity through wind. But it's also whatever side you are on ethanol and biofuels, and there's multiple sides. We're a leading state in generating, going into this source of fuel. So it's just interesting that that what's happening, and that the society is going to have a chance to decide how are we going to power our cars and what's going to be the need to do this. So I think there's a lot of unanswered questions. I think the burden should be on the company, not on citizens. So the burden should be on the company to prove that, to minimize or not eliminate any kind of problems for humans, but also for wildlife, for habitat, for wetlands, for water. And we just don't have the answers. I mean, I'm not saying I know all the answers yet, because we haven't even seen the permits. The permits still have to be filed. So I think there's a long list of questions. And then there's this whole question about coming onto people's land. You know, there's this, you know, Iowans have this kind of property rights movement. And I'm not saying that the Environmental Council, we're a coalition of about 60 groups. But I think some of our member groups, and certainly some of our individual members, are just going to have problems with surveyors coming onto people's land. And they're going to say, we don't want you to come onto our land to survey the land. So there's really a long continuum of concerns that I think Iowans are going to have.
Well, of course, if they're being compensated for the eventual placement of the pipeline, they might change their tune a little bit. My concern, one of my concerns, and I think that will be shared by others, is that, you know, at the negotiating table is the Iowa DNR, and you know that is an organization that has kind of lost credibility with Iowa citizens because of its underfunding and certainly because of its you know, blind eye to many of the abuses of corporate ag.
Well, DNR is understaffed, but I think it's also important that DNR has certain statutory authority on this, and the other authority on permits is going to be with the Iowa Utilities Board. So some of it, I agree. I mean, our council tries to support DNR because we think they are understaffed. But there's also statutory authority that some of the key decisions are going to be before the Iowa Utility Board, another state regulatory agency that the public still has some opportunity to influence. It may not necessarily be DNR who's going to have the final say, although DNR will certainly have control over certain permits and land and impacts on wetlands. But I think the initial thing, decision, is going to be around the Iowa Utility Board, if it even goes that far.
One of the things that always, the tone that always is established by corporations in this context is, this is inevitable, this is going to happen. It's just a matter of, you know, how much resistance we get. We'll throw on the community information sessions, but in the end, this is where it's going. But, you know, there could be other alternatives, other directions this pipeline could go. For instance, if you said that it was, there's a refinery in Minnesota, you know, maybe it could head across North Dakota to Minnesota. That would certainly be a shorter route.
Well, there were two previous pipelines planned to bring Bakken crude to sort of the southern United States, and I believe they both went through Minnesota, but neither of them, I think, got the commercial backing that I guess this company has been able to generate for this particular pipeline. And I'm not sure why that is. From what I was able to read, I couldn't find a specific answer. But it could be just that this company has a shorter route, and so the unit costs are less for transporting it this way.
And actually, you raised some really good questions, because some of this raises not in my backyard syndrome. I mean, I think there's people that kind of like pipelines and maybe like oil, but they don't want to lose that amount of land. When you talk about fair compensation, I think you're looking at, 10 or 20 feet either side of a pipeline that is going to be limited. I'm not sure in terms of the limitation on its use. I may be wrong on the.
It's a good question. I'm more familiar with pipelines from when I lived in Texas. We had them running right through our subdivision.
Right.
But in agricultural land, I'm not sure what the constraints are and whether you can plant over them or.
So there's those. And so some of the, I think those farmers are going to have a not in my back, which we understand. We all have a NIMBY kind of syndrome, because we don't have really a national land use policy. We have certainly EPA. And we don't even have a state land use policy.
Right.
So there's another thing that's going to be happening with these pipelines, which is interesting, is that what entity do we go to make decisions over the use of land in our cities and counties? And it's really, that's been a battle, not just on pipelines, but on other issues. Who do we want to say makes it a final decision? Because these pipelines are going to cross not only the 17 counties in Iowa, but elsewhere. And so I think there's going to be local communities. I think there's going to be counties that are going to get involved.
Really?
Yes, I think so.
Well, that's very interesting. Is there anything else you'd like to add, either of you, about this pipeline that's being developed.
Well, I thank you for doing this. I'm really glad you brought Franica from Iowa State. I think it's really important to have science-based decisions as well. I'm really glad you invited someone from the environmental community. And I think it's terrific that KHI is covering this because this covers so many different issues, and it gives the public an opportunity to think through all these issues.
Well, thank you very much, Ralph. And thank you for both for coming in.
Thank you.
All right. So, welcome. After the break, we'll be looking at an upcoming cultural event. This song is your clue to what that event is. All you have to do is substitute the word kids for the word people in the chorus.
Time it is relative to where you've got to be. There is a clock on the console of your car telling you the time it is relative to how far you've got to go before you're there at your destination. Be a place of work, a place to rest, for the water and bowl. But the question remains, well, what is time? It's when the sun comes up, the sun goes down, the moon comes out, the people dance all around. Time is not a condition in which we live. It's a condition in which we think, and we can change the ways we think. So the question remains, well, what is time? It's when the sun comes up, the sun goes down, the moon comes out, people dance all around.
Culbert.
Welcome back to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Every July in Ames, there's an event when the kids dance all around.
So, if you guessed the Kids Co-Motion Performance Workshop, you would be correct. And this year, we'll be exploring time in the form of history as they help us to celebrate Ames' 150th birthday here
in the
studio.
You don't want to say sesquicentennial?
I didn't want to butcher it, so I figured that was the next best bet. Here in the studio are two kids who are participating in this three-week workshop. Gabby Colbert and Alicia Turnbloom. I'm sorry. Welcome, girls. Say hello.
Hello.
Hello. We also have Valerie Williams, the director, artistic director of Co-Motion Dance Theater.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning. So for people who aren't aware, let us know exactly what is this organization? Who are you all, essentially?
Co-Motion Dance Theater is a professional modern dance company based in Ames, and we have a couple of outreach programs. And one of those programs is Women in Motion, and one is Kids Co-Motion. And Kids Co-Motion is a three-week performance workshop in modern dance that happens every July. And we start with nothing except a bunch of really enthusiastic, smart, creative kids, boys and girls, ages 8 to 18. And then we do a fully produced performance at the Ames City Auditorium the last weekend. So on July 25th and 26th, we will be doing a performance, a modern dance concert of dances at the City Auditorium. And these two girls are participating. Gabby has danced, is this your fourth year?
This is my fourth year in Kids Co-Motion.
There we go. And this is Alicia's first year.
Yes, but when I lived in Florida, when I was younger, I took ballet and tap.
Cool. So some of the kids come to us with dance experience, and some come with absolutely nothing but fine minds.
That's good. Sometimes that's the best tool. So you girls, you're pretty excited about this performance?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so what would you say your favorite part? Out of this three-week process, what would you say your favorite part is?
I would say dancing in front of people. I like doing that, so yeah.
There you go. Well, you're in the right profession.
My favorite part is getting to know different people and working with sometimes difficult and sometimes simple people.
Oh, that's an interesting comment. So is it silly time together? Is it serious time together? How are those interactions among the kids there?
Depending on the kids, you have to be quite serious. And with some other kids, you laugh a lot, sometimes get yelled at, but it's really fun.
The kids yell at you?
No, Valerie yells at us.
Well, you're relative, so you'll probably get a little more, right?
Yeah, probably.
No, actually not. I forget. How shall I put it? In rehearsal, there is no family. And we're all family. So we develop an ensemble among the 25 kids who are participating, and they become an ensemble. So instead of little enclaves, or they become a concert group. It's very, very cool.
I was going to ask Alicia, that you've had instruction in ballet and tap. How does this experience with kids' commotion differ from that kind of dancing?
Well, in ballet and tap, you had to be more serious with the teachers who are teaching you, like, the movements and stuff. And you had to be more serious with, like, people around you, because that's just the way, like, how you have to do that. And in kids' commotion, you can be fun. There's more fun dances and funner.
How about being creative?
More movement.
More variety of movement?
Yeah.
Okay. You told me earlier that you've been dancing for some time now. So are you, what are the different types of dancing you've been exposed to?
I've done kids' commotion, ballet, tap, jazz, and pre-point.
Okay. So, for the people who aren't too familiar with those, myself, what the last one you said pre-point?
Pre-point.
Pre-point. Okay, so what exactly is that? How is that different from?
That is preparing you from ballet into point shoes, where you're standing on completely your toes, and it develops your feet for that.
Okay. Like on Save the Last Dance. Okay. Please tell me you've seen that movie.
Yes, I have.
Okay. Cool. Okay. So, Valerie, what would you say your favorite part of this program is? This 3-week program. What would you say your favorite part of it is?
I love having the kids be creative. So, kids' commotion, we do a technique class every day in which the kids work very seriously on basic technique. Turnout, strength, flexibility, coordination, control. We do exercises that lead us into the movement that they're going to be doing in rehearsal in the afternoon. So we have that technique class every day. Then we have a composition and improvisation class. From the technique is 10 to 11, and 11 to 12 is composition. And I really love watching how the kids take an idea and develop it into a dance. So we learn we don't just learn dances. We really learn also how to create dances, how to make up dances. And for a lot of kids, you know, you go out in the yard and make up a dance. You don't have to consider the audience. You don't have to consider what the audience is seeing, you know, what portion of your body you're seeing. We require that the kids pay attention to all of those aspects of creating dance. And, you know, having all of those ideas in the room at the same time is just, I am excited all day long, every day. Cool. It's so cool.
That's good.
And back to that word, sesquicentennial, I understand this performance is also going to share some of Ames' history with the audience.
You know, sharing Ames' history, can I say that we're inspired by Ames' history and inspired by Ames now, then and now? For instance, we're looking at, we're doing a swimming dance. And we're inspired by some really wonderful photographs from the Ames Historical Society, who have been absolute angels about sharing photographs. We have a photograph from the early 1900s from Lake Comar. There were lots of, turns out there were people who just like dug ponds in their farmyards and had lakes.
Oh, that's down by Story City?
Yes, Lake Comar.
And I've heard of
that. Then pools started being built, like a carpool. There's this wonderful photograph of people, kids, standing on a diving board when carpool first opened in 1926 to the water slides of the current Aquatic Center. So we're looking not just at...
Which have been repaired, I hear.
Yes, and the girls can attest to that, can't you?
Yes.
Because they've been on them this... not this week when it's been cool, but last week. So tell us about some of the other dances.
Well, we are recently making a train dance, which is really fun. So we get to pretty much act like trains.
We are working on a Clifford dance that, like, from...
Clifford Thompson, the world's tallest man, who he was 8 feet 7 inches tall. And there are these really wonderful photographs of Clifford standing with his arms above the heads of 6 foot tall men. So,
was he from Ames or just visited?
He was having his car repaired. Isn't that funny? He stopped into Ames and had his car repaired, and there's this wonderful photograph of him towering over everybody else. Well, Kids Co-Motion is for kids ages 8 to 18, so we do have people ranging from how tall is Minnie Michaela? Oh, you know, like 44 inches tall to 67, 68 inches tall. So we have, you know, that 2 foot difference. And I thought, oh, well, you know, we should do a tall short dance.
Oh, fun.
That's exciting. Well, we are running out of time here. So just one more time, could you let people know when and where this event is taking place?
Kids Co-Motion will be performing at the Farmer's Market this Saturday at about 10:30 at the Farmer's Market, so the corner of Burnett and Main Street. We will also be performing at the Ames City Auditorium at 7:30 p.m. on Friday and Saturday, July 25th and 26th. Tickets are available at the door. You can get more information at comotion.org. That's comotion.org.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, ladies, for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Vivica, do we have time for... I think we have time for a few announcements there.
Yeah. Yes, we do, actually. So, before we get out of today's show, just let people know a couple things that are going on around Ames. On Saturday, August 2nd, the Ames Police Benefit Association invites you to their fourth annual golf tournament. 8 a.m. registration and open driving range. 9 a.m. shotgun start. The public is invited to participate, and this event will be held at Venker Memorial Golf Course, and that's at 1925 Stank Road here in Ames. For more information about that, go to venkergolf.com. That's spelled VEEKER golf.com. The second weekend of the Iowa Games kicks off tomorrow through Sunday, July 20th. The last game will be held Friday, July 25th through Sunday, the 27th. The Iowa Games take place annually each summer in July in and around Ames, with an estimated 15,000 athletes participating in more than 50 games. Their website gives a detailed schedule of all the events, so feel free to go to iowagames.org for the schedule. The American Solar Challenge is coming to Ames on July 26th from 1 to 4 p.m. The action will be at the D2 parking lot north of Jack Trice Stadium. See the local cars designed by college teams who will be stopping in Ames during this national race across the country. See Iowa State's Team Prism car. Enjoy hands-on activities and demonstrations about solar power for all ages from Iowa State and community organizations and businesses. For more information, go to engineering.iastate.edu/solar-challenge-sci. Again, that's engineering.iastate.edu/solar-challenge-sci. And that's going to wrap it up for the announcements for today.
Thanks, Vivica. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Vivica started out the show with an interview with Merle on the Move about the NBA draft, right?
Yep. Quick update on everything that's going on in the world of sports.
Then we heard from Vicky Granada, media representative of the Energy Transfer Partners out of Texas, who wants to build a pipeline across Iowa. Our local guests were Franna Kashuk, assistant professor of the Department of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences, and Ralph Rosenberg of the Iowa Environmental Council.
And we ended out the show with interviews of Gabby and Alicia, two participants of Kids Co-Motion, which will move next week into Ames City Auditorium for final performances next Friday and Saturday.
We've been your hosts, Greta Anderson and Vivica Dillard. Rebecca Brown engineered the show. Our website is back up and running, so if you want to recommend this show to your friends and share a link, visit khoyfm.org later in the day when our link to a podcast is up.
KHOY is a production workshop as well as a show. If you'd like to join our team, come down to our studio at 410 Douglas or contact us through our website.
As always, your participation as audience is what makes KHOY possible. Thanks for listening and
see you on the radio.